All right, we are continuing in lesson 36, which is the review of the Old Testament empires. And according to what I recall anyway, we were down to about question 17 or 18 on page 147 of your book. This question that we have up here, though it's not numbered, is question 17. I think we've already covered that one. As we have a review of the Old Testament empires from lesson book page 147, remember that we are covering the, as I mentioned to Randy, this is the chapter test, but it's actually, six chapters, so 30 through 35. So if you were to look in your table of contents on page Roman numeral 7, you'd see that we're talking about the fall of Israel and the Assyrian Empire, Judah's last days, and Judah after the fall of Israel. And then there was a review of the divided kingdom, and then the captivity, and talking about the Babylonian Empire, and then the rise of the Persians, talking about the Persian Empire. And then Jerusalem is rebuilt was the last one that we looked at. And the map, of course, is Judah, the return from captivity. So these, as we see, go back all the way to lesson 30, the fall of Israel. So we're way back from time to time in the book of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. So we're not just sticking right now with Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Malachi, all those folks, but they'll be interspersed in here. Just be aware that the questions for this lesson are in your lesson book, Lesson 36, page 147, and we're down at question number 17. This one that's on the screen right now is question 17, and we've already answered it. What is the empire that had laws that could not be changed? It's the Persian Empire. Okay. And then the next one is that the empire took the people of Israel captive from 2 Kings 17. So what empire did that, took Israel captive? Syria. Syria, right. So, I'm not getting the question up, am I? No. Okay, so yes, Assyria took the people of Israel captive. They're the ones that did that. And as we looked at before in question 16, it says this empire was known for its cruelty. That was also the Assyrian Empire. So that's the one that we talked about last time. Now, this empire took the people of Judah captive. We see that in 2 Kings 25. And that would be Babylon, yes. So, most of these questions are equivalently easy. Now, Mordecai, however, was given a position of honor in which kingdom? We see that in Esther 8 through 10. In the Persian Empire there. Okay. And then we look at, this is all the way back in Exodus, the 19th through 24th chapters. Who's make a great nation of his. This is God fulfilling promises. I'm sorry, we changed sort of subject matters here, didn't we? Mordecai was the last one. And so answer briefly. Okay. All right. So this says then, when did God fulfill his promise to Abraham to make a great nation of his seed? What event? Yeah. He delivered them from Egyptian bondage. So under the hand of Moses. So that's good there. When did God fulfill his promise to Abraham to give the land of Canaan to his seed? And we can look at Joshua, the 21st chapter, for that. These are all kind of, they're not subjective, but I mean, we're not all going to come up with the same phraseology here. And some of these questions are difficult to try and figure out. So when was he going to give the land of Canaan to his seed? It's when the children possessed the land under Joshua. Amen. Yeah, took it. You probably said that, right? I just didn't listen. All right, brief answers continuing. What promise to Abraham was still not fulfilled by the days of the captivity? So a reference to Genesis 12 and Galatians 3. The seed promise, right. Or he has down here death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. But that's what that is, the seed promise. So, where do we see the promises to begin with for the first time? Genesis 12, right. So we have all of the things. Which are the three promises? nation, land, and sea. And where did we see the fulfillment of the land promise, or the fulfillment mentioned of the land promise? Joshua 21, the end of Joshua, where he says, yeah, you've gotten everything that God promised you. Yeah. All right, brief answers. How long was the captivity of Judah due to last, according to Jeremiah? 70 years. If we don't have that down yet, we need to go back and do a little more studying, I think. So, and then now, which king would allow the Israelites to return and rebuild Jerusalem, according to Isaiah 44 and 45?
Cyrus.
Cyrus, right, yeah. Okay. Did God keep his promise to allow a remnant of the Jews to return to their homeland? And when did they do that? Okay. Right. It was the first year of Cyrus, right? First year of Cyrus. And we saw that almost 50,000 people returned. At least that's what's enumerated in the scriptures there in Ezra chapter 1. When you total all those numbers up. Yeah. Did God bless the returned group as much as he had offered? And why would we answer that that way, the way that we do? So, yeah, right, right. So, he didn't bless them the way that he had originally offered because they didn't turn to him and act the way that they were supposed to because they continued in their sins. So we see that in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi, all talking about the fact that God would bless you if you would just follow after my word, but they wouldn't do that. All right, now we have the big long thing of put these in chronological order. So what do we got first as we go through this list? Promises to Abraham. Notice the one is there now. So, and then what do we got? Exodus. Okay. And then? Obviously then Leviticus, right? No. Wandering. Okay. Wandering. Then what? Conquest. All right. And then? Judges. Right? United. The other one. Yeah, the older one. And then which one? Divided kingdom, of course. And then number 8? Assyrian captivity came first, and then what happened? Then the Babylonian captivity. And number 10, the return, and then the temple, and then what? And then the walls. Okay, so those are fairly easy. You start going through them, you think, I actually remember those. That's pretty good. And then now we have under the, who was it? Match the following names with the proper description. Some names, it says, will not be used. So, all right. Who was it? Who's the prophet who was sent to warn the Assyrians? Yeah, it's Jonah chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. I don't know. Yeah, you're right. Isaiah was the one. Yeah, right. So, who personally and single-handedly rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem? Same guy? Yeah, we're giving all these answers away by just putting the book there. But yes, I have a tendency to not believe that Nehemiah was actually the one that rebuilt the walls. Nehemiah was the one that directed the rebuilding of the walls. The what? Yeah, that's right. He just clapped the hands and said, jump. They said, how high? Okay, who was it that, who was the prophet that said God left, who was the prophet who said that God left the temple in Jerusalem? I don't know why we put the scriptures up here. Yeah, it would be Ezekiel. That makes a whole lot of sense, doesn't it? The Jewish maiden who saved her people from annihilation. And you'd find the answer to this in the book of Esther. So we're gonna consider that that's most likely Esther. But here's the tough one, though. Who personally and with his own hands and none other rebuilt the temple from the ground up?
God.
Zerubbabel was the one in charge. Now, that which return to the land of Palestine was that? Was the firstest one, right? So the one where 50,000 people came down? And what they laid the foundation, and then what did they do? Yeah, they decided to quit. And they did get discouraged because the bad people were there. Was that Sanballat and Tobiah and all those? Right. Because it wasn't Cyrus anymore, right? It was, was it Darius? I don't remember. Right. Oh, anyway. Maybe that'll come up here later. So, anyway, Zerubbabel was in charge of making sure that the temple got rebuilt. But all they got done was the foundation, right? And then it laid unworked for how long? 16 years. We just get that by looking at the kings in the text, which year of what king it was. And then, but when they finally did get to work on the temple and went to finishing it, how long did it take them to finish it? No, that's the wall. 4 years. That's correct. So it took them 20 years essentially to get the temple rebuilt. But they weren't concerned because they had what? Their own houses. Yeah. So, at least when we look back at Solomon, we see that at least he built the temple first and then he built his palace, which took a whole lot longer, right? Was that like 13 years to build his palace? Yeah. It's pretty big. whose primary goal was it? To restore worship. Yeah, I'm just thinking that's probably a pretty good guess. Yeah. Could be in Ezra 7. Most likely is. All right, so here's another tough one then. Of course, you can already see that in your book. The prophet who urged the completion of the temple. And you can find this in Haggai chapter 1 through chapter 2. So I'm going to go with Haggai also. I think that's a fairly safe prediction there. We need to edit these charts. The prophet who said, close the doors of the temple. You can find this in the book of Malachi. So that would be Malachi. Very good. We're all very good at this. The prophet who rejoiced over the fall of Assyria, and we can find this in the book of Nahum. So it would be Nahum. Yeah. And here we go. Here's one that's just local enemies of the Jews who returned to Jerusalem. Local enemies of the Jews who returned to Jerusalem. Let me say that right. Nehemiah 4 and 6. And we already mentioned a couple of them. Who's that third one? Geshem. Right. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. Geshem, I think, was the one that they said was the Arabian. Is that correct? And then Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah. I think he was just called the friend or something, wasn't it? Or was... He was what? A German?
A servant.
Oh, servant. Okay. Yeah, there was somebody. Yeah. All right. That's a servant. That's right. And from Ammon. All right, now see, the book's not going to give this away either. So the foreign king who had to learn, quote, God rules in the kingdoms of men, we see that in Daniel 4. Who was that? Good old Nebuchadnezzar. So he learned all that. Well, that was the last one. Well, I thought this was going to take a while. Okay, so that takes care of just our review of those six chapters, or whatever it was, 30 through 36, seven chapters. Let me pull up chapter 37 or lesson 37. We're talking about world affairs during the years of biblical silence. So let's just go into lesson 37, and we may do a bunch of reading and stuff here, but we're talking about the time of biblical silence. Now, Does anybody have a thought as to how long that period lasted? 400 years. Who was the last book that we have written about? Good old the Italian prophet, Malachi. Yeah. So Malachi was the one that wrote the last book, and it's felt that it is in the proper chronological order, that it's about the time that Malachi wrote that there was silence from God. And the scriptures talk about the fact that there was silence from God, or silence of God, I should say. So as we look then through the times during the years of biblical silence, what extra biblical books are we going to look at for a certain amount of reference? The books of Maccabees, okay? And depending on what version of them you're reading, you may have 1st and 2nd Maccabees, or you may have 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Maccabees. It just depends on how they were broken up in the particular version that you have. The book or books of Maccabees are not considered to be canonical books. In other words, they're not considered to be inspired. There are a number of things within the books of Malachi that indicate that God didn't write them. Not that there's a statement in there that says God didn't write this stuff, but the things that are mentioned in there sometimes don't line up with the way that things actually happened, or they don't happen in the right order. These are non-inspired books. The books of Maccabees have never been considered in the canon of the Bible, as near as I can recall, at any time or in any version. I don't know a lot about the history of the books of Maccabees, but we do understand that... Yes?
I think you said they've never been considered at any time part of the canon in any version.
As far as I know...
That's not true.
Oh, well, the Catholic...
They can't do it.
Right, that's right.
They're included in the Old Testament, so I think they consider them.
That's true. And we refer to them as what kind of books? Apocryphal books. Okay. So, and we refer to the Apocrypha, and there's a certain number of books in there some are additions to other canonical books. Others are separate books by themselves. For example, I believe there's one book in there called Bell and the Dragon, and I believe it's an addition to the book of Daniel, as I recall, maybe something else. And then, of course, there's those four books of Malachi, or two or four books of Malachi, depending on how they're broken up. Did I say Malachi? Yeah, I shouldn't say Maccabees. At least in this instance, they both start with the same letter. Yeah. So, but there's a lot of good historical stuff to look at. And you'll remember when we were going through our study of the book of Daniel, We did look in the book of Maccabees from time to time, because we can see some of the kings that we're talking about in the book of Daniel appearing historically in the books of Maccabees. Plus, there was the story that Mickey found in one of those books of Maccabees about the woman and her sons, and how faithful they were when the Greek king was throwing them into the fire and they would refuse to blaspheme against God. And so there's a lot of things in the books of Maccabees and in the other apocryphal books. Now there's several other books that are non-canonical books supposedly written during New Testament times. What do we call those? See if you've heard of them. The lost books? No, we don't want to call them the lost books because they're not lost.
History Channel calls them.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. Yeah, the History Channel calls them a lot of things. So, the pseudepigrapha, which means, pseudo, of course, means false, and epigraphine means to write. So it means false writings. And you've heard a lot of people have been talking about the gospel according to some other person.
Judas,
yeah. And I think there was one that talked about the fact that, as far as they were concerned in that book, that Jesus and Martha were married? Mary Magdalene, okay, yeah. And then there There was one of those so-called gospel of somebody's that was really popular in the last couple of years, that everybody was doing stories.
Thomas.
Gospel of Thomas, yeah. That was, everybody was, you know, thinking that this is wonderful. Here's additional stuff. And of course, all you have to do is watch all that junk on the History Channel. I can't stay on that for more than about 20 seconds. I have to turn it off. Because you know that they're making it up when you hear them speaking. So, yeah. So, it's kind of like saying, well, you know he's lying because his mouth is moving. So, anyway, there's not a whole lot to be said, but there are a number of things. And when you study how we got the Bible, or we study the canon of the Bible or the canon of the New Testament in depth, you'll see how these books, all the books that we have, both in the canon and not in the canon, were looked at over the years, and some were accepted and some were rejected and such alike as that. And the thing that we have to remember is much like what God told Nebuchadnezzar, is that God rules in the kingdom of men, generically speaking, and he's given us what he wants us to have. What is there's one, now I'm trying to remember where it is. Is it in the book of Revelation where it talks about, no, where it talks about, you read the epistle from here, or give this epistle to the folks at Laodicea, and you read the epistle from Laodicea. Where, do you remember where that is? Is it Colossians? A lot of people will say, well, we don't have a book of Laodiceans. No. One might come to that conclusion, but one also might come to the conclusion that since these books were distributed around to different churches, that all he's saying is to the people at Colossae, go grab the book that Laodicea has right now, whichever one that might be.
Colossians 4:16
says,
when this letter is read among you, have also read the church of the Laodiceans, and you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea.
Right. Read my letter which is coming from Laodicea. Right. So, that's not to say that we're missing a book of the gospel according to Laodicea or something like that. It's just that Laodicea had a book that Paul wanted them to read, that Paul wanted the folks at Colossae to read, and he said, you folks at Colossae, take the book that I've written to you and give it to the people at Laodicea so they can read the exhortation that's in there. So that's how they did that. But so many people make a big to-do about a lot of these things that they just want to make up things as they go along. We have how many books in the Bible? How many in the Old Testament?
39.
And the New? Would be the remainder, right? So, 66 books total and 39 in the Old and 27 in the New. And there's never been any reason to question any of these books. Also, it's also interesting to note that as you do a study of how we got the Bible, that almost all of the books of the Old Testament have a quotation somewhere or other in the New Testament. And also, if you read the works of what are called the anti-Nicene Fathers, and then the post-Nicene Fathers or something. Anyway, there's a Council of Nicaea in 300 something, where essentially that was sort of the foundational meeting that led to the establishment of what later became known as the Catholic Church. But there were a bunch of people that wrote before that that were Christians. But it's interesting to note when you start reading these, what are recalled the anti-Nicene Fathers, which means the people that wrote before the Council of Nicaea in 300-something. 325. So that's 325 A.D. There were a lot of people that wrote, and these people that wrote, some of them were actually right at the end of the first century and some at the beginning of the second century. And when you start looking through these, there were some of these people that wrote, and they listed all the books that were in the canon. And there are very few differences between what they have and what we have today. Some of them, the books were just reversed in order or something like that. Others, they may have had one or the other of the apocryphal books that they were thinking about. Some of them said, well, here's a list of the books that are definitely in the canon, and then they've got another ones out. Here's the ones that I think ought to be in the canon. You know, to very loosely paraphrase people that were speaking Greek anyway. So it's a very interesting study. So we did study how we got the Bible in the teenagers class in the back room a few years ago, and it was a very interesting study. Might be worth our while to study that out here also. I've got a couple books on the canon of the Bible and the canon of the New Testament that are, you know, that thick, that talk about, you know, a lot of times we think that, well, in, you know, 400 B.C., God said, these are the books, they're all set, that's it, here's a list, and you guys just keep it. Now, it was, the people gathered the books up, as it were, and gathered them together, and over the years, concluded which ones were authentic and which ones were not authentic. And of course, we can look through a lot of the fragments and things that we have today and realize which ones have held the test of time. It's also interesting to note that things like when we went down and saw the Dead Sea Scrolls a number of years ago, and it's interesting to look at those and realize that those things came out of a cave in Israel and they were written way back, almost at the time of Jesus. I believe the Dead Sea Scrolls are all Old Testament. I mean, and then there's a number of doctrinal books by the Essenes or whomever it was that wrote these things. But nobody's ever even thought about considering them canonical. But it's interesting to look at these things, especially the biggest scroll that they have, which is the Isaiah scroll, which has got almost all of the chapters of Isaiah in it, complete, you know, but the way that things age over the years, you know, broken pieces on the top and the bottom and things like that. But to look at those things and think that somebody right near the time of Jesus was the one who actually wrote those things down is really impressive to look at. So, now those folks, of course, wrote during and after the time of Jesus. So we're not looking at the years of biblical silence here. Now, also during the years of biblical silence, and maybe all this will come up. I haven't looked through all these charts because I thought we'd still be in questions. Also during the years of biblical silence, there was a very important work that was translated in Alexandria. What was that?
Septuagint.
The Septuagint. And what is the Septuagint?
Septuagint is the Old Testament translated into Greek.
The Old Testament translated into Greek. So they got a bunch of scholars together in the city of Alexandria, which was the local,
library.
It's the local. It was a scholarly city of that particular area.
They were the ones who were collecting up all the books they could find in the whole world, right? Was that that time or another time? The Library of Alexandria?
Well, I think the Library of Alexandria did have many books, yeah. And it ended up getting destroyed somehow, I think. So the reason that the Septuagint is named the Septuagint is why? They suppose that there were about 70 scholars working on this. You go through and start reading through how we got the Bible again, or the canon of the Old or New Testament. Say, well, it wasn't exactly 70, and they were all working at the same time, and it's not, you know, so it's, anyway, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Randy?
That's the version that was quoted by Jesus.
By who?
Quoted by Jesus.
Oh, the Septuagint was the version quoted by Jesus and the apostles. Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why when you go into the New Testament and you read a quotation that says this is from Isaiah so-and-so in your footnotes, and you go look at it, it's not generally the same wording that you see. It's because they're quoting from the Greek translation of the Old Testament, because that was what all of the people used at that time. So since Greek was the language in favor at the time of Jesus and around, then that's what they used, and it was much more efficient for them to do that when they quoted from that. Also, though the official language of the Jewish religion is supposed to be Hebrew, what language was most common at the time of Jesus? Aramaic, I believe. And so when you see the quotation by Jesus on the cross, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, that's an Aramaic quotation of the beginning of Psalms 51.
What do you mean by
50, Aramaic? 22. Yeah. Aramaic? It's a variation, it's a Semitic variation of other languages in that particular area. Aramaic was actually spoken by the Babylonians and the Syrians, I believe. And so it became the language of preference in the Palestine, Syria area somewhat before the time of Jesus and through his time. So several of the quotations that are made in the New Testament, when you look them up, they're actually in Aramaic. Jenny?
One of the things that I had noticed when we were studying back in the Kings and the Chronicles was that in the New American Standard that Randy would read from, anytime we were talking about the Syrians, they called them the from Aram. They're not from Syria. They're from Aram.
Right.
So Aramaic.
Right.
Most likely was something to do with the Syria area.
Okay.
So that's
yeah.
The dialect that was spoken up there in the north. And
right. So somewhat north of Palestine, and perhaps maybe as far up into Turkey or something like that, because Syria's pretty big and takes, I guess Lebanon is over on the coast, right? So all of those folks probably would have spoken Aramaic, and it got to be very popular apparently in Palestine also, so that became the common language of the people. But it was now in a transition over to Greek. That's why the New Testament got written in Greek. But several of the quotations are from the Aramaic language. When we look at the Old Testament, aren't the quotations from Nebuchadnezzar, aren't they in Aramaic? Doesn't our Bible say that these are in Aramaic? Or is it another language? I'd have to look. But so many of the quotations that were by Nebuchadnezzar, because it looks like there were certain areas where Nebuchadnezzar actually wrote this text, and in those things your footnote will say this text is, I think it says in Aramaic. I don't think there's another language you have to worry about. Joey?
To your point a few moments ago about the canon, we have to believe by faith that God's providence plays a significant role as well.
Yes, providence does.
What books end up
right
in the canon. We have to understand that God would protect the integrity of his word, that he would see to it, that the canon would be set correctly, if you will.
Right.
Otherwise, God failed to get us his complete word.
Right, exactly.
It's clearly not possible.
Yeah.
So it's not just, I agree with you. You know, over the years, people have just decided this belongs and this doesn't, based on scholar studies and all that. But we have to know that behind the scenes, God would see to it.
That's right.
That he would protect the integrity of his word, and we would have the whole complete word, nothing more, nothing less.
Nothing less. That's exactly. Right. And that's one of the things that we have constant concerns about with people that we talk to that are from denominations or out in the world or something like that, that how do you know that you have the right word and this things like that? You say, well, God has given it to us. It is here, and it's been very stable for many thousands of years. So God has provided for us, and that's essentially what providence means. So that's what we've got. So there's a number of things, books and things that were essentially lost that there might be quotations to. But we don't see those books around. Yes, ma'am.
That's how we instead of the Bible, that's how we know that it's from God, because he said prophets, they spoke, it was inspired prophets that spoke.
Yes.
Through God.
Right, so with inspired people that spoke through God. And in the New Testament they said just goes sort of along with it. There's no scripture that is a private interpretation. So God has given us the words that he wants us to have, and there they are. I think one of the fascinating things that's interesting to look at when you look at a study of how we got the Bible is that you realize that the Bible, the King James Version of the Bible, was translated in the early 1600s by a bunch of scholars in England, but the manuscripts that they used were not too far divorced from them. I mean, maybe 500 years in the past or something like that. And I think that one of the sources that they used was like a Greek translation of a Latin manuscript. So the Latin had to be translated from something else. So it's like a third hand. It's like taking this copy and making a copy of it, and then taking that copy and making another copy of it. And by the time you get it 10 times, you can't hardly read the words anymore. But the interesting thing is that we look at the King James Version that we say was completed in about 1611, and we look at those, and then here in the 1940s, somebody finds a whole bunch of scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they start translating those, and we see that there are no fundamental differences between what was said in the King James Version that was translated from not as good materials as these Dead Sea Scrolls back in 1611, that there's no fundamental differences between the translation from 1611 and the one we have in 1945 or 7 or whenever the Dead Sea Scrolls. And a lot of times we have a tendency to think that the Dead Sea Scrolls were the last time that anything major was found regarding the scriptures. But actually, many fragments and documents and things like that have been found since that time. And all they do is just back up what was already there. And you think back in 1611 when King James had that translated into the people's language, you'd think that there's going to have to be a lot of changes between then and now, but there weren't. And so as you say, Joey, with the providence of God, we have what he wanted us to have.
See God protecting the integrity of his word throughout
right.
the generations.
Yeah.
The century.
Yep. So.
Richard.
Yeah, Randy.
You were asking about Daniel. From Daniel 2, verse 4.
Daniel 2, verse 4.
The text is in Aramaic.
Okay.
All the way through 728.
All the way through 728, the text is in Aramaic. So, yeah. So, if we look at those, I think we'll see that that's actually a narrative by Nebuchadnezzar, isn't it? I
not
think.
The whole thing,
but a lot of it, yeah.
The part where he's talking about the Jews.
Oh, right. And Carolyn, did you have a comment?
We recently just ran into somebody in the neighborhood who was, you know, stalwart of King James 1611 and anything else. I used to work at a Christian bookstore. We had people who came in, and that was the only thing. They got nothing else. How do you talk to people who, there's nothing wrong with that version. It's just that it's really hard to read, and it's another layer that we don't have to read if we choose not to, but they think that there's just nothing better and that the ones today are just somehow inferior. How do you talk
about that? A lot of people feel that the translation of the King James Version was inspired. In other words, yes, they feel that the words in English that were put down were inspired words. And so there's a lot of that feeling. But the fact of the matter is that there were no inspired men around at that time. The last inspired man died when? Right in that neighborhood, yeah, when John died. That would have been the last person. There were some people that had those gifts. So, you know, but it couldn't be much later than the year 100-ish, you know. Certainly not as late as 120. That's it. Because earlier than that, the apostles could lay their hands on people and give gifts of understanding and things like that to other people. But what couldn't those people then do? They couldn't pass it on. So we look at which story to find that out in the New Testament. The book of the story of Simon the Sorcerer. and chapter 8, right?
Philip went to Senegal and talked to all of them, and they needed the apostles to come and lay hands on
in order to receive the Holy Spirit, right? And, yeah, because Philip, who was just an evangelist that had had hands laid on him, so he was second generation, as you'd say, and he could not give the Holy Spirit to those people that he converted or helped to convert in Samaria. And so they had to call for the apostles, Peter and John, right? And they came up to Samaria and they laid their hands and they were able then to give the gift of the Holy Spirit. And that's where Simon got in trouble. You know, so
you mean today people can't lay hands on and have those abilities?
They can't lay hands on and have those abilities these days. It just don't happen. You know, they think they do. And as far as, you know, an interesting thing is there was a, and there still is a congregation in Belen, New Mexico, which is like, what, 40 miles south of Albuquerque, I think, or 20 miles maybe. There was a congregation that was supposedly a sound congregation, but right up inside, when you walked in the door, I'm told, I haven't been to that building, there was a sign up there that says, the King James Version only is used in this church. No. Whoa. A lot of people may like the King James Version because they say, well, it reads beautifully, you know, read through the Psalms, and it's very, you know, poetic and such alike as that. But the fact of the matter is the King James Version was no more inspired than the American Standard or the New American Standard or anything else. Randy, edit.
I just wanted to also read John 19, verse 20. Therefore, many of the Jews read this inscription for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was also written in Hebrew, Latin, and in Greek. That's what was written was Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. But next to Hebrew, there's a marginal reference that says, i.e., Jewish Aramaic.
Jewish Aramaic, so there's probably a dialect. Yeah. And I thought the American Standard Version in that area says written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. But I'd have to go back and look at it in the American Standard. Remember, so what was it? Was it was where John? What?
John 19:20.
Okay. In the American Standard. Okay. I thought there was one that that mentioned something about Aramaic. Maybe it was in the Old Testament.
Maybe it was a marginal reference.
It could have been, yeah.
English Standard Version says Aramaic, Latin, and Greek.
Oh, okay. English Standard Version says Aramaic. All right. So, but I like the interesting footnote there that says Jewish Aramaic, because we do see dialects in everybody's country. When we went to visit Israel after having lived in Egypt for a while, and I listened to those people speak Arabic, I thought, they're speaking Arabic, but I don't understand the dialect. So I could understand a bit of the people that spoke in Egypt, but their dialect in Egypt was so different than the folks that spoke Hebrew, that spoke Arabic in Israel, that I couldn't understand what they were saying. So,
in my just little concordance in the back of my Bible, in the word Aramaic, there's three or four references. One of them is in 2 Kings.
2 Kings.
18:26.
18 through 26.
Eliakim, okay. The son of Hilkiah, and Shebna, and Joah said to Rabshakeh, speak now to your servants in Aramaic, for we understand it. Do not speak with us in Judean in the hearing of the people who are on the wall.
Oh, that's right.
Interesting.
Yeah, don't talk to us in the language that we'll understand, that the people will understand. So at that time, they hadn't really converted over to Aramaic, but Aramaic was obviously a distinct language at that time. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess that's it. Huh? So we will start actually on lesson 37 on Sunday morning, and. So I will attempt to remember to have the questions that I have for lesson 37 printed out so that you can just have the questions in front of you as we go through lesson 37, and it makes it easier to fill them out. Thank you for your comments.